Good morning, everybody. Everybody knows that when you're doing construction, things that are unexpected can arise. You begin to open up walls and ceilings and move things around. And as you do that, you begin to find things that you may have never realized were there to begin with, including this, the lovely carpet sample, this rusty orange. Apparently, at one time, this was the entire sanctuary. Everything. How many of you here were during the orange days? Thank you for staying with GBC through the orange years. We appreciate that. That's lovely stuff right there. one of the unexpected things that I thought I should let you know about that happened last week, if you walked in back here, you may have seen the block work that's being done in the hallway. And as you might imagine, whenever there's block work and there's cutting of things and all that kind of stuff, there's dust and there's a lot of it. And so the masons who are here working on it, they had actually closed off all these doors in the hallway, and they'd open up the back doors so that all that dust could kind of just go out into the parking lot. But it was cold. So they also had set up heaters with like a blower on it to try to keep themselves warm so that they could stay warm, get the dust to go outside. As you might imagine, it was just a big gray mess back there. Well, I, as happens a couple times a day, week, whatever, at some point, I'm tired of emails and all that, and I want to go see real men at work, so I get up, and I go, and I creep in, I kind of peep through the windows to see what's happening. Well, it just so happened that I came in this way, because I knew all the doors were shut, and there's very small little windows there, and so I was kind of looking through those little windows. I couldn't see as much as I would like, and so I opened up the door. Now, I just told you about how much dust there was. When I opened that door, some dust started to kind of come in. I was kind of like, oh, you know. And one of the construction manager was here, and he goes, Ty, I wouldn't do that. And so I closed the door, like, do what? You know, like, I wasn't doing anything. And he said, that dust is, and then he said, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of it. It wasn't asbestos. If he'd said that, I would have remembered it. But he said it's like asbestos in that it's sometimes in the block. And so when we're cutting, we're doing all this, that dust is actually really, really bad for you. And I said, like, how bad, you know? And he said, well, look at what they're wearing. And sure enough, I looked through there, and all the masons had, not like hazmat suits, but they had like, clearly they were protecting their eyes and their nose and their mouth and all of that. And I'm looking around, right, and the way the lights are, I could see that dust was coming through here. And so I was like, so like, how bad is it? And he said, well, it's not like, it's more like a long-term thing. But if you start to feel a cough coming out or something like that, just let me know, and I'll tell you how to address it. Now, as soon as he said that, I'm feeling what y'all are feeling, right? I was like, oh, no. So don't worry. Just don't hit the pews very hard. If you do, you probably see that dust rise. No, I was thinking about this because, not because any of that happened. Before you're afraid for your life or you're Googling what other construction dust or you're texting your lawyer, set up this lawsuit. No part of that story was true except for the dorky pastor looking in on what they were doing. Okay, the doors were not open. There wasn't a cloud of smoke or dust. It did not flow into here, all right? So don't be afraid. Your children's lives are not being harmed or anything like that. But I thought that it's kind of a nice picture of what we're talking about today because it's one of those things that it's in the air. It's one of those things that you ingest it. There's a poison that a lot of us, without even realizing it, have breathed it in. And when we do that, you can't tell that it's there by a cough, but it starts to work on us, and it has some short-term, but certainly some long-term effects as well. And we'll see this poison all over the passage where we'll be today. You can't tell if you've ingested it because of a cough, but you might be able to tell that you have an issue with this poison if you churn internally when your friends succeed in places where you have not. You may have ingested this poison if you use excuses to explain why somebody else does things better than you do. You may have this poison in you if you generally temper all of your compliments with the word but. Like, oh, that was so wonderful, I loved how you did it, but. You may have ingested this if you complain that other people don't appreciate you as much as they should. You may have this in you if you tend to walk the other way rather than congratulate your friends on things that are blessings in their life or their good fortune. You may have this if you often gloat when you see other people get caught because you think, oh, well, they had it coming. You may have ingested this poison if you struggle to be friends with people that excel in your field. You may have ingested this poison and taken it deep into you if you say things like, well, I really like so-and-so, but I just want to make sure you have all the facts. So you always have to kind of undercut people. If you're way better at criticism than you are at giving praise, then you may have a problem with this. If you have a hard time believing that your friends or even your siblings simply might be more talented or smarter than you are, you may be infected. We are in week 3 of our Better Days sermon series, and we've been talking, and there's a little kind of verse from a poem that was read about how we're always looking for revolutions. We're looking for these great big things to happen. We want better circumstances. We want it to happen out there, but much of the time, God is not looking out there. He's looking in here, and he wants to see better hearts, and better days come about through better hearts. And we said that the people of Israel, they were looking to get a king, and they thought, well, that'll bring us better days. And they'd been warned not to do it because his heart wasn't right, but they didn't care. They said, give us a king. And they got one, and it didn't turn out so well. And then Samuel, the first week of the series, he was looking for better days. And God said, no, I'm looking for a man after my own heart. I'm looking for someone who has a better heart. Well, in the chapters that we're going to be getting into, specifically in chapter 18, so if you want to open there, you can. This is page 241 in your pew Bible. In chapter 18, we see that Saul is infected. He has this poison deep in him. He's a man who we see he's deeply flawed. He's deeply afraid. He always seems like he's afraid. He was afraid at the very beginning when he was supposed to be anointed. It said that he was hiding out among the luggage. He didn't really want to be the king. Then they made him the king, and then he has an opportunity to prove how brave he is, and there's this big old tall guy named Goliath out there, and Saul's like, oh, no thank you, and like waits for David or somebody to come along and to rescue him. So we see that there's this fear in Saul all along. There's this insecurity. But it's really the specific type of fear that gets a hold of his soul. And there's these two words that we use interchangeably, but they're a little bit different. It's jealousy and it's envy. They're like identical twins in that they look similar, but they're definitely different, and sometimes they get mistaken. And he has both problems here. I think that jealousy is the most obvious to see. In fact, in the Bible, it'll say, Saul's jealousy. Now, those little headings, those weren't actually in the original text. That's just an editor later coming along to give you some ideas. And I think we can clearly see his jealousy there. But really underneath that jealousy, I believe, is a deep, abiding, poisonous sort of envy that works its way into his bones. What's the difference? Well, jealousy is more the fear of losing something, okay? You believe something belongs to you and you don't want to lose it. That would be jealousy. Whereas envy is more the fear or the concerns or the angst about lacking something, right? Jealousy, I don't want to lose something. Envy is I look around, I see what you have that I don't have, and now I'm lacking that thing and I feel this sort of internal problem. And they can both work together. So a lot of times if you see a couple, and let's say he is jealous of her, and he's afraid that he's going to lose his wife or whatever, it makes sense that he values her and wants to keep her close, right? That makes sense. But jealousy is when it turns into this fear and this thing about I could lose her. But a lot of times where that jealousy is coming from is actually envy. It's that he realizes he's lacking, and that's why he's afraid of losing her. I mean, if the relationship was healthy and everything was great between them, he wouldn't be experiencing any of that. But it's the fact that he knows that there's other guys out there that are better listeners, have better abs, you know, more gifted, more money, more whatever. And it's really his own insecurities and fear about what he lacks that makes him jealous of what he might lose. So they both work together, but a lot of times jealousy is up here. Underneath it is envy. And as we get into this text, we'll see how Saul, the king of Israel, the current king of Israel, is really, he's jealous of David, but really underneath it is this envy of what David has that he doesn't. And this is what it says in chapter 18. As they were coming home, when David returned from striking down the Philistine, that's Goliath, the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with songs of joy, and with musical instruments. And the women sang a very catchy tune. And they sang this to one another as they celebrated. Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s. And Saul was very angry at this saying. It displeased him. And he said, they've ascribed to David 10,000s? And to me they've ascribed thousands? And what more can he have but the kingdom? There's the jealousy, right? And Saul eyed David from that day on. The next day, a harmful spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre, as he did day by day. Saul had his spear in his hand, and he hurled the spear, for he thought, I will pin David to the wall. But David evaded him twice. Now Saul was afraid of David. Why? Here's the envy, because of what he lacks. Because the Lord was with him, David, but had departed from Saul. So Saul removed him from his presence, and he made him the commander of 1,000. And he went out, and he came in before the people. And David had success in all his undertakings, for the Lord was with him. And when Saul saw that he had great success, he stood in fearful awe of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, for he went out, and he came in before them. This defeat of Goliath created a real problem for Saul, because this punk kid came along and did really what the champion, the king, should have done. So when David defeated Goliath and lifted up that big head, however big it was, and all of its gore, and then the people of Israel, the soldiers, they went rushing down the hill and they started to attack the Philistines. It's not hard to imagine that amongst the crowd of soldiers were other family members and messengers beside David. Do you remember? David went to bring provisions to his brothers who were in the military. My guess is a lot of family members did that. He's not the only one. Lots of people came and brought provisions. There were messengers there. So as soon as the soldiers descend down to go after the Philistines, I would guess as soon as the messengers and the family members saw what was happening on the field and, oh, we're winning, they ran home. You got to go tell mama that everything's going okay, right? They went home and they began to say, oh, it's you'll never believe it. The champion, Goliath, we've all heard of him, like the huge guy, right? And they're like, yeah. He was killed. His head was cut right off. Who did it? Saul? And they're like, no. Some kid. What's his name? I was hearing people say David. So I like, David? Who's David? He's just this kid. I don't know. Good looking kid. Young guy. You know, not very big. Whatever. It was a slingshot. It was the craziest thing I ever seen. Just, you know, sound effects, the whole works. And he killed him. And the people are like, whoa, an upstart kid? Yeah. And then our people are, the Philistines are on the run. We got this. And they're getting excited. When the boys come home, I mean, I can only imagine what this would look like. I mean, we've seen pictures of like VE Day and things like that where there are different celebrations and parades. But when these boys come home and the mothers get their sons and their husbands and whatever back and they're looking at them and they're like, are you okay? And they're doing the once-over routine, right? Like, any scars? Did you get cut? Are you hurt? You know, whatever. Hey, have you eaten today, right? That's what moms always want to know. Yes, mom, I'm good. And so all these people in the villages, in the cities, they hear about this before the military comes back. So when Saul and his guys, still feeling pretty good about this victory, go back home, every town they hit, they're greeted by cheers and ticker tape and, like, you know, feasts and food, and people are running out to them, telling them how awesome they are. And I would guess, knowing sometimes how leaders can be, that Saul had pretty much convinced himself that this celebration is going to be for me. I mean, come on, right? I could have taken Goliath out if I wanted to. I just had, like, logistics. I had other things going on that I needed to stay back. Besides, I gave David the little prompt that he needed in order to go out there. I mean, by then, you all have worked for this guy before, right? Or you're an academic advisor or something. You know, the person who convinced every good thing that you've ever done is actually because of them. And my guess is in Saul's mind, as he's approaching home and he hears the songs, and he especially hears that first line about how Saul's killed his thousands, he's just like, yes, yes, bring it. And then he hears it. And David is 10,000. What? He's angry. He's been told by Samuel before, he'd been told in chapter 13 and 15, Samuel had said, look, your kingdom is gonna go bye-bye because you rejected God. And all of a sudden, when he hears this song, he starts thinking, I'm going to lose my kingdom to this kid. Now, in some ways, you'd go, well, that sort of makes sense. Yeah, I mean, he doesn't want to lose something, right? But on the other hand, it's a punk kid. He's a head taller than everybody. This is a teenager. This is a teenager who can't even wear his armor. I mean, it's just a moment. And yet he begins to look at him, and something starts to stir in him. And it says that as soon as he kind of lets this poison come in, it starts to drive him crazy, essentially. He was angry at the saying, displeased him. He said, they've ascribed to him 10,000s. To me, they've ascribed thousands. What more can he have but the kingdom? And he eyed David from that day on and becomes fixated on him. He becomes fixated on what's he going to take? What am I going to lose to him? And then notice the timing of this. He's fixated on him. The next day, a harmful spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre, as he did day by day. It's like the next, he begins to fixate, what can I lose, what can I lose? And then this envy and this jealousy kind of takes root, and he starts to lose it. He starts to lose all sense of reason. He, like, anger just seeps into his soul. He looks at David, and in David he sees everything that he's lacking. He looks at him, and it says he was afraid in verse 12 because the Lord was with him, and it departed from Saul. The boldness that Saul knew he should have but didn't, he saw in David. The faithfulness that Saul lacked toward obeying God, he saw in David. The just sort of winsome personality where everybody likes David. I mean, Saul's daughter falls in love with him. His son thinks he's the coolest guy ever. I mean, everybody loves David. Saul sees all this affection, and he realizes that's all lacking for me. And beyond that, he recognizes that the Spirit of God is actually on this guy, and he's not on me anymore. He knows that David's only succeeding because of God. That stone didn't just, like, it wasn't just that David was awesome. It was that God was actually part of sending that stone. Saul knew that his lack was David's gain. It was what David had. It wasn't that David was trying to take anything from him. It was just that David had everything that Saul wished that he had. And try as he might, David's esteem grew as Saul's shrank. And it becomes kind of the way that they operate. Just jealousy and envy down deeper and anger. So much so that Saul tries to kill him multiple times, twice. The writer wants us to know just how quick, I guess, David was, or how bad of a throw Saul was, because he escaped twice. Make sure you get both times. And it just becomes the way that they operate. Sometimes Saul's like, oh, I love you, man, I love you, I love you. And then the next minute, he wants to kill him. And it's all because he recognizes in David that David has something that he's lacking, the very Spirit of God. There's a bone-rotting reality to jealousy, but even deeper, to envy. When we begin to look at other people and breathe the poison of envy in, it starts to rot us from the inside out. It messes with our motivation. It messes with our satisfaction. It damages our relationships. It starts to have this sort of nagging impact in our lives that we cannot escape from. And Saul breathed it in deeply and lived it out. I was reading a pastor who was talking about envy, and he said a couple things that I really liked. He said, envy hides. He said, it's the sin that nobody confesses. He said, in my 22 years as a pastor, I have listened as people confessed almost every sin known to mankind. He said, I've listened to people confess murder, adultery, theft, abortion, lies, sexual deviation, you name it. I've listened to people confess everything. But nobody has ever said, Pastor, I want to confess the sin of envy. He said, it's the sin that nobody talks about. I started to go through the big seven, right? The seven deadly sins. And I started to think through, will people confess these things, admit to these things, embrace these things? Because envy is on that list. The first one is pride. We all know people that just embrace pride, right? They just double down. Yeah, it's just who I am, you know? I'm just a jerk. Sorry, that's what I am. And then they could put a cool beat to it, and then they sell the album, right? Like, this is who I am. I'm so great, blah, right? They just double down on pride. I'll confess my pride. I'll even engage and embrace my pride. People aren't afraid to admit pride. What about wrath? Look, there's some people like, oh, I have an anger problem, whatever. But we all know the person who loves their anger problem. We all know the person that kind of gets off on the power that they get from being really angry. We know that person. Anybody will admit, oh, I have an anger problem. Usually it's followed up by, and it's you. You know, like, you're the one that causes me to be angry. But we hear people admit that all the time. What about gluttony? Well, very rarely will people, I mean, unless it's like man versus food, but very rarely do people like go, oh, well, I have a gluttony problem when it comes to food and stuff like that. But when it comes to drinking, I mean, people all the time brag about how much they can drink, how gluttonous they can be. Oh, I can, right? We've heard that. Greed, all the time there's people who just double down on their greed, how great their greed is. Laziness or sloth. Now, that's not one that's super appealing in our culture here because it's kind of a high-driving Ann Arbor thing, but we've all known people that are just too cool to work, man. Yeah, I'm lazy, but it's because I don't buy into your stupid system, right? And they take another hit, whatever, right? We've heard people confess that and brag about it. Lust. People brag about their insatiable lust and their appetites and, oh, I'm just, you know. People brag about that all the time, and they'll confess it every day of the week. You know what they don't confess? Envy. It's this sneaky, weird poison we take in and we don't talk about. Another thing that he mentioned about is that envy can be more pronounced in fairly successful people. Like, there are some people that are in such hard shape in life that they just start to assume that nothing's owed to them, and the life is terrible, and it's all unfair, and they don't even think about it. But those of us that are like somewhere in the middle rung, you know, there's people below us, and there's people like a tier or two above us, we are the ones who tend to struggle more so with envy because we can look and do the math. Well, I know why I'm up here and you're down there. It's because I'm this, this, and this. But what I don't understand is why you're up there and I'm down here. And we start to do all of that math, and envy tends to be more pronounced in fairly successful people. Envy also tends to strike hardest with the people that are closest to us. We rarely become super envious about somebody way over there. Like, okay, yes, they live in San Diego, perfect weather, whatever. I'm envious. But that doesn't like rot our soul. It's annoying in February especially. But it doesn't rot our soul. The envy that rots our soul is the envy we have of our siblings. Or the envy we have of our spouse because our kids like them better. Or the envy we have of our lab partner. Or our academic kind of competitor who always seems to be getting everything. They're going to get published and I'm never going to get published. Those are the ones where it's kind of close, where it has the greatest impact. And it makes us believe the worst about those people. Envy is this thing that when we take in, it kills us. And we look at others and we want to take even the stuff from them just so we can have what they have because we know that we're lacking something. I read a story about this guy who's trying to get rid of these biting ants. Okay, they're like poisonous biting ants. And he said that he took the poison granules and he dumped them kind of where he saw the ants congregating. And so sure enough, right away, the ants went over in their nice little orderly ant fashion and talked to each other, so let's get this stuff. And they picked up all these little poison granules and in a nice little line, they went right back to their nest. And he thought, wow, that's a lot like envy. You know, you like grab this poison and take it right into your home. And he left and he thought, well, that's good. It'll kill all the ants. And then he said he came back later. And what he noticed was there was still some of that poison was being taken by the ants to their little nest. And he said it was so fascinating because going into that nest was this orderly line and going out of it was another orderly line. It was a different kind of ant, not a biting ant, but that was stealing the poison from the first ants and taking it to their nest. And I'm like, there's something really poignant about this idea of we're always looking. What do you have that I don't have? And we're willing to go get it, even if it's poison. Well, I'll take that. And that's what we see in Saul. He's jealous of losing his kingship, which he should be. But deeper down, he knows that he's lacking something. What's fascinating about this is when Saul eyes David and he begins to rave within his house in verse 10, where does he hurl the spear? He thought, I will pin David to the wall. In Saul's envy, his anger is directed towards David. He's mad at David, but where should his anger be directed? Come on. Where should Saul really direct his anger? Well, probably himself, right? I mean, probably he should look in the mirror and he should think, it's my fault. I've made terrible choices. I've rejected God. I've done exactly the opposite of what he called me. I didn't go step out against Goliath. Probably, if anything, he should have been upset with himself rather than David. It's not David's fault that God's blessing him. David just happens to be this person that God's blessing. He should have been angry at himself. Who else should he have directed his anger towards besides himself? I would suggest God. Let's go for it, right? Like once I'm done taking it on myself and saying, well, I caused this problem, after that, if we're really going to be envious and we're really going to be honest, we ought to go after God. Because it's God's fault that David is better looking than Saul. I mean, it is, right? It's God's fault that David's more athletic. It's God's fault that David's more winsome. It's God's fault that David is a bolder guy. It's God's fault for making David better in some ways than Saul, right? I mean, if you're Saul, you could think that way. Have you ever felt that way? God, why are they so perfect? It's so annoying. We never look at like the perfectly like handsome and capable and funny and whatever person, and we're all like, oh, I just love how God's blessed them, right? What do we say? I hate them. I hate that person. Everything's so easy for them. Shouldn't we be mad at God? He's the one who made your siblings smarter than you, better looking. Oh, not my siblings. He's talking to somebody else in the room, right? Not my siblings. But he's the one who gave them those blessings. So if we can be mad at ourselves to some degree and maybe mad at God to some degree, how do we deal with this? If this poison is something that we can take in, we obviously don't want to turn into speared attempted murderers, right? How do we deal with it? Well, don't worry. I've saved you some time. I Googled this. How to deal with envy. Okay? Fountain of all knowledge, Google. So here's what I've learned. There's two ways for us to go about this that our culture suggests. Okay? And you can write it down if you want, or Google it, either way. The first way that culture suggests that we should deal with our anger, or our anger that's a result of envy, is that we should simply kind of go the minimalist routine or the Buddhist routine, which is to say, I actually need nothing. Okay? So the way that you can get over your envy is to say, I need nothing. I will have no desires. I just don't need anything. What I want to do is I want to sit back in my one robe that I'm going to wear every day and look at everybody else and judge everyone because y'all, you're bought into the system. You always got to get the newer iPhone and the blah, 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 right? I'm not like that. I don't need anything. I've squashed all of those desires in myself. So I need nothing. That's how I will get rid of envy. In fact, if you look up how to deal with envy, at least this morning when I was looking it up, about half of them were from different Buddhist organizations and lines of thought that were all about this kind of minimalist approach. It's about needing nothing. Okay. There's something right about that. You don't need the newest phone. You don't need all the stuff. We have too many clothes that we don't wear in the closet that's too big to make any real sense. We have extra space in our garage, which are these little houses for cars. Like, we don't need all of the stuff. So there's something to that, right? We need nothing, right? But it's not super satisfying of an answer. Okay, so here's the second approach. The first one is you need nothing. That's how you deal with your envy. Just come to that recognition and just be a minimalist. The second option that I found, and there's a whole bunch of different ones that fall under this heading, is you can achieve anything. First one, you need nothing. Second one, you can achieve anything. I read a bunch of these. There was actually an article I read yesterday or today that said that envy gets a bad rap. Because here's how envy works in a good way. When you look around and you see something that you like and it makes you go, oh, I wish I had that. So like a boat was the example it gave. If you were to look around and you see, wow, my neighbor has this tremendous boat, and then inside you felt this like envious, gross thing come up, don't worry. Don't be mad about it. It's fine. You know why it's fine? Because what that's telling you is what you really value. So here's what you need to do. If you really want a boat to make you happy, just work harder. Use your envy as a big old lever to help manipulate yourself into working harder to get the things that you really want. You can have whatever you set your mind to. Right? That's what culture says. You need nothing, or you can achieve anything. And both of those are like, okay. It's okay to work harder for things that you want. That's okay. It makes sense to not need all the new stuff, but it's not truly deeply soul satisfying. There's a third option. We read a little portion of it in Psalm 73 earlier. Psalm 73, if you have time this week, we studied this a couple years ago. If you have time this week and you're thinking about this issue of envy, dive into this psalm. The first half of it is like, I'm envious and my faith is struggling. I almost want to die. It's this worship pastor. They're always dramatic, right? So it's this worship pastor, and he's all like, I'm so envious of these younger people and blah, blah, blah. But by the second half of it, he begins to turn to God and say, God, it's sort of your fault. But even as he starts talking to God, he starts to realize a third option. A third option that isn't, well, I need nothing or I can achieve anything. But the third option that he happens upon is that in God, he has everything. He says this, and we read some of this earlier. Nevertheless, I'm continually with you, God. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel. And afterward, you will receive me to glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? There's nothing on earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Culture tells you, you need nothing or you can achieve anything, and the gospel tells us that in Christ we have everything. See, Christianity is totally backwards. Not that you need nothing. It actually says, this is very comforting to my soul. It doesn't say you need nothing, Ty. It says you are nothing. That's the beginning of the story of the Bible. You're nothing. God owes you nothing. The world owes you nothing. In fact, your very best is a filthy rag to God. That's what it tells us. It says it's not that you need nothing, you are nothing. And it's not that you can achieve anything you put your mind to. You really can't achieve much of anything. What you need is someone to come along and give you everything. And that's who Christ is. If we're going to address our envy, we cannot address it with, well, here's seven steps, and get away from the gospel. The gospel is the core reality of who we are. The gospel is what tells us that Christ, though he was in the form of God, he did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. The gospel tells us that it's Christ who died and was resurrected so that the justice and the wrath of God could be satisfied, death could be defeated, and we could be God's children, heirs of his great eternal kingdom. It's not that we need nothing. It's not that we can achieve anything. It's that Christ is everything. That's the beginning. You cannot address the poison without the solution of the gospel. It doesn't work. Now, some of us are like, yeah, but I am a Christian. I've known that for a while. You talk about Jesus a lot here, right? Like, I know. But I still feel it. And I would still like a couple, just can you give me a couple quick things that would remind me so that tomorrow or the next day when I'm talking to my sister or my lab partner or whatever, that person that drives me crazy with how smart they are and capable, are there a couple reminders? Here's a couple quick ways to keep the gospel at the center of our lives. A couple quick things. First is we need to pray and confess to God that we believe he owes us something. We need to regularly say to God, I believe, God, that you owe me something. And that's why when I'm behaving so properly and things happen so badly, it makes me so angry because, God, you're supposed to treat me better than this because I'm one of the good ones. God doesn't owe us anything. He gave us everything in Christ, the end. We need to pray and recognize and confess to God himself that we believe he owes us something. That will keep the gospel at the center. We also should confess not only to God, but we should look for somebody else in our lives that we can trust, that we should confess our envy to. And we should tell them, not that they're the person we're envious of, but I'm dealing with envy in this circumstance with this person, and I know it's not right. We need to be the people that are willing to confess the truth, not the other six of the seven deadlies, but all seven, and say, this is an issue for me. The truth is, musicians generally envy musicians, politicians, doctors, sports people, academics, you go on and on and on, pastors. You generally envy the people that sort of look like you. They just seem to do it a little bit better. So we need to find somebody, maybe not in our same field if we can't handle that, maybe in a different field, and say, listen, I'm dealing with this. I need you to call me out on this and pray with me about it. Confess to God we think he owes us. Confess to somebody else, maybe not in the same field, maybe, but someone that we can trust that this is an issue. And then lastly, we need to look for opportunities to celebrate and serve the exact people that we might actually feel our envy towards. Look at David. He's looking at a king, and he knows he's been anointed, and he should get that kingdom someday. He kind of knows that somewhere in the back of his mind. We don't see any envy coming out of him towards Saul. But part of the reason I think that is because he's constantly serving Saul. He's constantly celebrating Saul. If there's somebody in your life who seems to just always be better and do better and you just have that thing, I would say you become the person that celebrates them the most. And not in a fake, oh yeah, awesome job, but inside you're like, I hate them. But I mean like you work at it. Because when we begin to celebrate and serve people, we put others before us, we are modeling the work of Christ. The solution to this poison is not that we need nothing. It's not that we can achieve anything. It's that in Christ, we have everything. We have the only thing. May God protect us from this envy. Let's pray. Father, Saul was legitimately concerned about losing something. He was jealous, but deep down, he knew that it was because of what he lacked, the obedience, the faithfulness, the humility, the courage that David had. And David certainly wasn't perfect, but God, it ruined an opportunity in a relationship that was actually kind of beautiful. It was almost a father-son relationship that they could have had, and it devolved. So Father, I ask, as we walk out of here, as we consider ourselves in light of this, as we keep asking ourselves if we believe really that It's okay so long as I have, as long as I know Christ. It's okay so long as he's done the heavy lifting in my soul. It's okay no matter what my circumstances are. It's going to be well with my soul. God, would you remind us of that? Give us opportunities to celebrate others and to pray real prayers to you of confession, and maybe even talk to somebody we trust so that we never breathe this kind of poison in, and instead we just feel and pray and worship and declare the truth that Christ is everything. I pray this in his name. Amen.